Welcome to The Gut Connection with Brian Jerby, MD, where we discuss the connection that gastrointestinal health has with all of health. We review the latest research and interview the greatest minds in this rapidly advancing field of gut health and integrative functional medicine. Please keep in mind that this podcast is provided for educational purposes only and should not be considered a substitute for care from a licensed medical professional. This podcast is provided on the understanding that this does not constitute medical advice or other medical services. If you would like more information about Dr. Jerby and the type of medical care that he provides, please visit drjerby.com. That's drjerby.com. Now, let's get to this episode of The Gut Connection. Hi, and welcome to another episode of The Gut Connection. And today we are pleased to have Dr. Joshua Goldenberg with us on the show today. Dr. Goldenberg is a researcher with numerous publications. He's a teacher, a naturopathic doctor, a founder of Doctor Journal Club, and the list goes on and on. And knowing him for a short time here, I know that he's most passionate about how research impacts clinical practice. And his research focuses on small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, or SIBO, irritable bowel syndrome, evidence-based practice, research methods. He's a research investigator at the HealthGut Research Institute associated with the National University of Natural Medicine in Portland. And he has a private practice at the Goldenberg GI Center. And as a naturopathic doctor, Dr. Goldenberg focuses on integrative approaches to small intestinal bacterial overgrowth and irritable bowel syndrome, as well as other gastrointestinal issues, working in concert with conventional gastroenterologists when necessary. And most in line with what we are talking about today, Dr. Goldenberg established the first and only, at least the only one that I know of, hydrogen sulfide SIBO registry at this point in time. So welcome, Dr. Goldenberg.
Thank you. Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm excited to chat about these super exciting topics.
Yeah, and I just recently interviewed Dr. Mark Pimentel, who has done a load of work in this area, as you know. And I'm just super excited about the hydrogen sulfide registry because it really is an interesting way to look at things. Dr. Pimentel's group's done a lot of great stuff, but what you're doing is great too, because it looks at what's going on out there in the clinical world versus what's going on in the laboratory or in a very controlled research setting, which is necessary as well. But in your opinion, why, or just tell us why the hydrogen sulfide registry is a needed thing? Why is it important?
Because we know nothing about it.
Good point.
So, I mean, I think, you know, you put the nail on the head. I mean, we wouldn't be here as SIBO researchers and SIBO doctors without Pimentel and his lab. They've done, you know, the vast bulk of this work. And his, you know, his affiliated lab, Jamili Lab, is, you know, the came out recently with this hydrogen sulfide breath test. Now, what quickly became apparent is that clinicians started treating hydrogen sulfide like, you know, out of the gate. In fact, we've been treating it for a while, even before we had the test. We have different, we had different ways of making that diagnosis or that that hypothesis. And so, you know, what became apparent to me is that we needed a way to capture a huge amount of knowledge that the clinicians had already or had acquired. And that was sort of the cutting edge of what was available research-wise. And then also, you know, with this new gas machine, this new machine that's called TrioSmart that can measure hydrogen sulfide as well, we would actually get some objective data. And a lot of these clinicians would have pre-test, post-test, et cetera. So it made sense to me that this would be a perfect time to capture the clinician's experience with cases. So basically to have you know, not one case report, but 100 case reports of many, many different clinicians and their experience to see what's working for them, what's not. So that was the idea, is to kind of capture that community of knowledge and experience that we have as SIBO clinicians, because we don't have yet the randomized controlled trial data and the more formal observational data that we really, really need. And we want to do that too, but that, you know, there's a big lag time and clinicians need information, patients need that information. So this is a way to sort of cut that lag time a little bit shorter and get us some information faster that we could then, you know, leverage in more formalized research settings.
Yeah. So, you know, I've done a couple of entries into it and I thought it was, pretty simple, mm-hmm. well designed and everything. So maybe tell our practitioners out there, I mean, how does it work? We'll definitely put the link on in the show notes to the registry. Mm-hmm. But is there a lot of time spent by practitioners when they enter the data?
No, so thanks for contributing to it. We really need these data points. So we kind of designed it with the busy clinician in mind. So, you know, for example, we beta tested this out. It takes probably less than 3 minutes to fill in the details. So let's say you had this is how I do it anyway. You have a patient come in and you're like, you know what? I think they've got hydrogen sulfide SIBO, or you just got a TrioSmart back, or there's a flat line or whatever it is, or clinically, empirically, you're making that diagnosis. Ding, ding, ding. You think, oh, registry. You pull up the link, which you'll be kind enough to put in the show notes. You put in the basic information about the patient, you know, how you made the diagnosis, et cetera. And then, you know, exit out. You get a little automated code that you can put in your patient chart, come back to it later and update it when the patient comes back for treatment. And yeah, it takes about, you know, less than 3 minutes. I do it when I'm charting. So, you know, I finish up with my, you know, my patient. I'm closing down my chart and all that information is already in my head. In the same time in a different tab, I'm inputting the basic information on the registry. I grab the automatic code, I put it in the patient's chart note, and I move on. So it doesn't mess with any of my time. What I would say is a lot of people have said, oh, Josh, thanks for doing this. I've got all these cases I gotta, you know, upload once I have a free weekend. That never happens. We're all so busy. So just do it as they come, right? And so when you have someone you think you have who has that, you know, pop open the tab and get the information in and we can all benefit. And we'll, of course, make all the information that we learn available to everybody so we all get better at how to treat this this condition.
Right. So I noticed you mentioned empiric diagnosis, flatline diagnosis, and then, of course, now we have the TrioSmart breath test, which is a way to measure hydrogen sulfide, which has only been available for about a year, mm-hmm. and maybe a little over. So, what were the main ways of diagnosing it before we had this technology available to us, just to help our listeners?
Yeah. So, what we used to do is basically there were two things that would usually happen. So, there were these quote unquote, pathognomonic signs and symptoms that we thought was associated with hydrogen sulfide. And if we have time, I'll share, you know, early findings from the registry on that, which is interesting. And so if they had this cluster of symptoms, we'd say, that sounds like hydrogen sulfide. And we'd call that like an empiric diagnosis. The other approach was if you used a lactulose sugar for a breath test and you didn't stop at 2 hours, you went all the way to three. Basically, the theory was since lactulose is not absorbed, the third hour gives you an insight into the large intestine for hydrogen. And normally you should have a rise at that point. If you didn't have a rise in that third hour, you know, we call that a flat line in the, you know, third hour flat line, that was suspicious. And the idea was that perhaps there were some other organisms there that were eating up that hydrogen. And so it wasn't absorbing into the blood and being breathed out in the breath. And so One thought there was that was hydrogen sulfide bugs. And so those are the ways that we would make that diagnosis or that hypothesis. And, you know, one of the things that's very interesting to me, and this is not my idea, I think I stole this from Dr. Seebecker, Allison Seebecker, which is, you know, what if these are three different entities, what we were calling, hydrogen sulfide SIBO based on symptoms versus flatline versus high hydrogen sulfide gas. if what if these are actually all three different things, and therefore they would respond differently to treatments? And so, you know, that's one of the really interesting questions that the registry can, you know, tantalizingly give us some indications about, right? If we can, if we have enough cases, we can divide it up in these three buckets and see if people respond better in one bucket versus the other. So there's just so many questions that we have for hydrogen sulfide. And I'm hoping with a rich enough data set, we can dive into this a little bit more.
Yeah. Yeah. And what I'm doing is I'm leading up to some of the surprise things maybe that you found out from the registry, but typically tell our listeners what we as practitioners looked for when we were thinking about hydrogen sulfide as far as signs and symptoms.
Yeah. So like there's the classic ones like, you know, egg flavored burps and flatulence, or sensitivity to sulfur containing foods like eggs. What else? Skin manifestations was one. There's the thought that urinary tract issues were associated with it as well. So those are sort of the classic ones that we would often think about for hydrogen sulfide, and especially if someone presented with like a cluster like that. It would be, you know, sort of like a ding, 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 ding. Sometimes, yeah, I think I mentioned skin manifestations. That would be another one. But yeah, so and that was kind of the thought, is that, oh, this is the phenotype of hydrogen sulfide patients.
Yeah. And we always thought their symptoms would kind of be on the more toxic level.
Yes. Yes.
And you know, a lot of times we thought it was only associated with diarrhea. Mm-hmm. And I think Dr. Pimentel's, the way he did his study design, it was pretty much diarrhea limited. Mm-hmm. But anyway, in light of all that, in light of the fact that, okay, we had to do some empirical diagnosis, we had to do some flat like diagnosis, and granted, we were probably wrong some of the time. Mm-hmm. Maybe some of these symptoms didn't fit with a positive hydrogen sulfide, maybe not. So like you said, there's lots of questions out there about clinical manifestations and diagnosis of hydrogen sulfide SIBO. And then there's also the question, maybe you can address this. There's also the question of, is hydrogen sulfide SIBO a different entity from hydrogen sulfide, maybe what we call LIBO, or large intestinal bacterial overgrowth? Mm-hmm. And maybe, do you know, and I'm asking the question because I don't know the answer. We do know that large intestine has sulfate reducing bacteria such as D-sulfovibrio, Bilophila, Wadsworthia, some of those guys. Does that happen in the small intestine? Does that sort of overgrowth happen, or do we even know?
Yeah, so I don't think we know. So this is interesting. So again, are these different entities? So, you know, one of the things that I've heard some practitioners talk about, so Dr. Jacoby, for example, you know, has this thought that there's, you know, you've got these large intestinal hydrogen sulfide producers that are, you know, one part of the problem. We know one organism that may be associated from research this year in the small intestine, and that is Fusobacterium. And the thought is that, and this is this was published in a poster out of the Cedars-Sinai School, out of the Pimentel lab this year at DDW. And it was a mouse study, right? So super limited, but basically they took someone, like they had isolated this Fusobacterium from someone that had hydrogen sulfide SIBO. They basically gave a bunch of rats this organism, and then a bunch of rats didn't get that organism. And then basically they looked at, you know, what happened. And what they were able to show was that, you know, the rats that got this organism started producing hydrogen sulfide gas, measurable gas. And what was really interesting, whereas the other rats didn't. But what was really interesting is that that was also correlated with an increase in inflammation, inflammatory markers, as well as diarrhea. So they measured like the loose stool content of the rats. And that they all came up, it all ticked up in concert together in those rats that had that one organism. So, you know, it's early research, but they were able to show that, you know, this is an isolated organism from someone that might have this problem. And at least in an animal model, seemed to be associated with inflammation, diarrhea, and hydrogen sulfide. So, you know, that's a thought as far as what's going on, but we don't really know. I mean, that's really all that's been published at this point.
Yeah, yeah. And to that point, I mean, when we think of what's been published on hydrogen sulfide SIBO, I mean, there is a paucity of papers out there that even to support the existence of such an entity. I'm not saying it doesn't exist, but there aren't any papers that kind of are the definitive, okay, hydrogen sulfide SIBO exists, and this is a proof of it.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's a few papers out there, there's some that are hinting around about it. There is one paper that is out of China, and it's in Chinese, so I can read it except for the abstract.
Uh-huh.
But they had some surprise findings, and one of them is that the hydrogen sulfide SIBO or breath test elevation was correlated especially with constipation. Have you had any surprise findings in your registry about what some patients experience and who are then diagnosed with hydrogen sulfide?
Yeah, so that's interesting. You'll have to send that to me if you don't mind. I haven't seen that.
Yeah.
I think we have a shared colleague who is speaks Chinese, so maybe she can help us translate it.
Yeah, that might be great.
But so this is interesting, right? So classically, people are used to thinking of hydrogen sulfide as like a diarrhea issue. And I think that came out of this this one study out of Cedars-Sinai, again, DDW paper this year, that basically had like three cohorts, like quote unquote normal people, so people without GI complaints, people that met IBS-D, Rome 4 criteria, so diarrhea type IBS, and then IBS-C types. And this is Rome 4 criteria, so super strict definition of IBS. So this is a very specific population. And what they showed there is that, you had normal, I'm like figuring with my hands, but it sounds like this is an audio podcast, so I'm going to have to explain. Basically, you had normal folks, if they did samples, they would have hydrogen sulfide levels pretty tight around 1, 2, maybe 2.5, something like that. In IBS-D patients, they really clustered much higher. So you got 5s and 6s and 7s and 8s and things like that, right? And so when you ran the stats on that, there was a very clear difference between healthy controls and people with IBS-D according to Rome 4. And so that's where this association with diarrhea comes from. What isn't talked about a lot is the third group was IBS-C patients with constipation type IBS, and they were much more spread out, right? So they clustered where healthy folks clustered, but also higher. And then also that's just IBS patients. So people with constipation, functional constipation, other types of constipation were not tested. And what we're seeing clinically, you tell me if this makes sense with your clinical impression. I mean, I was seeing loads of people presenting with constipation and testing positive on hydrogen sulfide tests. And it was not a clear one-to-one diarrhea correlation at all. And, as best I can tell, it's like, well, the Rome 4 IBS is a very specific population that may look very different than most folks that walk in our doors with constipation. So anyway, I think that's part of it. And this interesting study out of China, and as you alluded to, the registry seems to be bearing out our experience as well. One of the questions is, okay, did they test positive or did you diagnose them with hydrogen sulfide SIBO? And then, what were their symptoms? And constipation, at least currently, is beating out diarrhea as the presenting symptom. So I think clearly there are many people with this diagnosis being diagnosed by clinicians who present with constipation. And so we need to be cautious about this assumption that, if they don't have diarrhea, it's not a hydrogen sulfide issue.
Yeah, right. Any other things that kind of caught you off guard as far as what the registry is showing?
Yeah, so that was a big one, I think. The other main one for me so far was, all these pathognomonic, these sort of these classic signs and symptoms that we just talked about. They show up on the registry, but they're not prevalent, right? It's not the most common symptom that people, describe their patients having when they make this diagnosis. And, so you got some skin stuff and some, egg flavor, this, that, and the other thing, and sensitivities, but it's, and the toxic feeling, right? That's one of the questions that we have. But it's very, very low counts, like less than 10% or something like that. Whereas the classic, the main presenting symptoms are what we'd expect for all SIBO, like diarrhea, constipation, bloating, things like that. So I think what, you know, so first of all, a registry is a super, you know, low quality evidence base, right? Because there's selection bias, who's putting in their cases, yada, yada, yada. But it's what we have. So there's always a possibility of selection bias. But assuming that this is representative of what's out there, you know, it's very interesting to me. And I think what the take home for me is, okay, maybe there may be pathognomonic symptoms, but that doesn't mean they're common. Like they still might be very rare. Like 80% of hydrogen sulfide cases still may not present with these classic symptoms. And so as clinicians, we need to kind of be aware of that, I think. And then the other stuff as far as like interest is what clinicians are using. And there are some clear, you know, winners there. You know, bismuth-based products are a big one, oregano, low-sulfur diets, and we just have no research on this stuff at all. And so this registry has already kind of spurned two new projects for us. We're doing a systematic safety review on bismuth dosing, right? So a lot of clinicians are using very, very high doses of bismuth. We don't have a lot of data on that. Is it heavy metal? Is it safe? Mm-hmm. Yada, yada. So we're starting that. And then also low sulfur diets, like what the heck does that mean? Like, how is that defined? What is it used for? And so we're in the middle of a scoping review on that as well. So we're trying to, the good thing about the registry was it was really about finding signals that could then be explored in more formal research settings. And that's already happening, which is great.
Yeah. So practitioners out there, really pay attention to this and get your cases in, because the more we put in, the more we can learn. And how many cases do you have so far, approximately?
I think we're at about 100 right now, and we're hoping to get a lot higher. Yeah.
It'd be nice to get 500, even 1,000.
Mm-hmm.
So the link to that, to the registry, will be in the show notes. And so make sure and pay attention to that and enter your cases, whether they be, and that's, it's true to say, whether you diagnose it empirically with a flat line or with a TriaSmart test, those are all welcome, correct?
Yes, and we need all that information if we want to explore whether they're different or not. And the other thing I'd say is this is all anonymous, right? So you as the clinician are anonymized. Your patient information is anonymous. There's no identifying information that's asked, just basics. And the thought, you know, because I've spoken to a lot of clinicians, some are nervous. They're like, well, you know, it's the first time I've diagnosed this. You know, I don't want to put the case in, but please do. And we don't just want the hero cases where everyone got better. We want to know, you know, what can we expect? You know, what's a success, a reasonable success rate to look for? What do failures look like? You know, et cetera. What do you do on a second round of approaches, et cetera? So please just basically, you got a patient, you make the diagnosis. Like the next thing I hope people think about is, oh, that silly registry Josh was talking about. Here's the link. Put it in while I chart. Done. Moving on with my day.
Right. So in your experience and the experience of the registry, what are people using besides, you know, bismuth for treatment of hydrogen sulfide SIBO?
Yeah, so it's pretty much, you've got three big winners, the oregano, bismuth, and low sulfur, and then everything else is pretty low counts. So things like rifaximin are scoring high. That's not too surprising. There's a lot of clinicians who are talking about that as a good option. Surprisingly, at least so far, we're not seeing like elemental diet being used, which is curious to me, because, you know, that could be quite effective for other types of SIBO. What are the other types? Metronidazole pops up a bit, Alinea. So there are sort of a smattering of different approaches that are being used. But what's clear is this sort of bimodal distribution of the big three and then everything else, which is very kind of interesting to me. And again, what's curious is because we don't have a lot of data guiding us, and I feel like we're a very tight community of SIBO practitioners, I think our practice is very much guided by, you know, leaders in our field and what they recommend. And so, you know, it's not super surprising that we're clustering together because, you know, we all talk to each other and we share ideas. What's interesting to me is that the success rate, at least according to the registry, is really, really quite high. So I think that's very interesting as well. So I'm very much looking forward to getting some safety data and clarifying data on low sulfur diets, safety on bismuth, and then I'm hoping we can run a proper trial on this now once we know that these are clearly the winners as far as what's being used. The efficacy seems really impressive from the registry information. Let's study it in a randomized controlled trial environment and see what we see.
Yeah. And the other thing, Josh, that I'm very curious to find out is if hydrogen sulfide can be produced by a number of different organisms, mm-hmm. Is there a way to do a breath test and do a study that incorporates both breath test and stool test concurrently to see if, does that correlate? Does a positive hydrogen sulfide on a breath test correlate with some sort of overgrowth in the colon? And when it does, what bacteria are overgrown? Is it desulfovibrio? Is it Bilophila wadsworthia? Is it, what is it? And if not, it's in the small intestine. I mean, that's gonna be a more difficult study to do, but could it be that Pimentel's right, and that it's an overgrowth in the small intestine of Fusobacterium, or even in the large intestine for that matter. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because the treatment would be different because they're different, you know, they're different phyla of organisms, and, mm-hmm. and that would kind of direct our treatment.
Yeah.
I don't know if you can, comment on that.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. And also think about the tools that we have available to us as clinicians and, you know, having these DNA-based or PCR-based microbiome tests that a lot of us are using, it's like, oh, we've got all this data too. Like, let's use it. So in the registry, there is a question for that. Like, did you also do stool testing? You know, what was elevated? We specifically ask about those organisms that you're describing. I'm hoping that if with enough data points, we can make that linkage, which I think would be very useful. And again, what if, you know, large intestinal hydrogen sulfide producers are treated very differently or present very differently than if it's a small intestinal problem? And like you said, they may be treated differently. You know, one of the interesting things, too, is as far as differentiation, because xifaxan is used in some cases, and that is small intestinally focused primarily, that could be an interesting way to differentiate, you know, where you're targeting these bugs. So, a hugely rich area to explore. But to your point, our clinicians are capturing this data anyway. And so the idea was, let's see if we can aggregate this in the hundreds and see if there are any signals that emerge.
Right, right. Well, it's great. I'm super glad that you're doing this work and that we have this available. You've made it easy and accessible to just pop on your computer, enter some data, and you're done. And it could really help move our field forward in understanding this very poorly understood entity. Again, just looking in the research, I'm kind of amazed at the paucity of papers that address this topic. Now, there's lots of papers out there about the fact that we as humans do manufacture a certain amount mm-hmm. of hydrogen sulfide, which is different, right, from the other overgrowths, which if they're only doing hydrogen, we don't naturally make hydrogen, and we don't naturally make methane. So if those are elevated, we know that that something else is making them. But do you know of any studies that have shown a something revs up the natural biochemical human production of hydrogen sulfide? Any disease processes?
Human,
or is it all bacteria?
Yeah, that's a good question. No, I'm not aware of that, which would be interesting for like controls and making sure you're not as false positive. Very interesting. So to answer your question, no, I'm not aware of any studies like that.
I'm not either.
Yeah, the best we know is from this, you know, this poster we referenced earlier, which is in about 50 healthy controls, you know, average hydrogen sulfide levels without people without gut issues. Are, you know, between around, you know, between 1 and 3, basically, mostly around 2. And it clusters pretty tightly. So that seems to be, I'm pretty comfortable with that being considered quote unquote normal. But yeah, that's the research that I'm aware of. And, you know, part of this is these machines have not been at least commercially available for a very long time. And right. other companies are trying to catch up now. And so once they become more and more available, I think we will see an explosion of research in this space, I hope. And so we'll, you know, hopefully we'll learn a lot more about this moving forward.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, again, the work that you're doing is great. And again, just everybody look, if you're a practitioner, look at the show notes and get the case registry link. It's easy to do. It can be done in a couple of minutes and it'll really help everything out. So any last thoughts or maybe tell people how they can find out about you and your practice and your work?
Sure. Yeah. I guess last thoughts is, thanks for the invitation. This is super fun. Like, I really enjoy nerding out about this sort of stuff and like-minded people. And it sounds like your audience is, you know, quite educated folks in this space, which is fascinating to me. So I love these discussions. I love trying to figure this out. And it's exciting to be on, you know, in a cutting edge. So this is what I tell patients. It's very frustrating from a patient perspective to be on a cutting edge because your clinicians aren't right. able to guide you. But on the flip side, it's like we're all learning together. And so it's this really nice place where, you know, patients, clinicians, et cetera, researchers, we're all kind of partnering together to share experiences and get better and better and help people more and more. And so, and it feeds itself, right? So what's cool about, usually research will drive clinical practice, but what I'm really excited about is clinical practice driving back research. And this is a great example of that. We use a registry, you capture clinical experience, and then that's going to drive formalized research that then hopefully then drives clinical practice. So I think that cycle is really what we should hope for as clinician scientists and as an informed patient body. So yeah, so I guess those would be my thoughts. And so I see patients at the Goldenberg GI Center, and if you're kind enough, maybe you can put a link. And I do yep. research at HealthGod and Texas A&M, and you can find me on PubMed and all that. But yeah, I just love this stuff, and I really appreciate the opportunity to chat about it and share the word about the registry.
Yeah, well, thanks so much again, and we will keep up with you and watch your work and try to add to the registry as much as we can and see if we can't make some advances, because there's lots of people out there who are sick and need to know the best way to treat these problems. So thanks again for all your work, and thanks for being with us here on our Gut Connection podcast today. And for now, we'll sign off. Until next time, I hope everyone listening has a great holiday season. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much. Take care. Bye.
And that ends this episode of The Gut Connection. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll look forward to having you back for our next episode, where we'll discuss more gut-related topics and interview leaders in this rapidly advancing field. If you would like more information, please visit us at drjerby.com. That's drjerby.com. Until next time, take care and may God bless you.